Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
South Sudanese leaders sign an agreement to end the conflict, and rights groups say Nigerian authorities knew in advance of the raid on the girls' school. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. South Sudan's military spokesman says armed forces are ready to implement a ceasefire deal signed late Friday, ending months of fighting with anti-government forces. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports leaders of the two warring factions, as well as world leaders, welcomed the deal.
President Salva Kiir and his main rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, agreed to the ceasefire during a meeting in Addis Ababa.
If we continue to work according to what we have signed, yes, this bleeding will stop.
By me signing today this agreement, I'm sending the signal this conflict must be ended peacefully.
Thousands have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced since December, when a political struggle between the two leaders broke out into violence that has prompted inter-ethnic attacks. Teams from the East African Group of Nations, known as IGAD, which has mediated talks, are expected to monitor the implementation of the ceasefire. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for the parties to immediately translate these commitments into action on the ground. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
France and Germany say they will support more extensive EU sanctions against Russia if the May 25th presidential election in Ukraine does not take place as planned. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande issued the warning during a joint press conference today in a German Baltic port. New sanctions are expected to target Russia's economy. The two leaders stressed the sovereignty referendum organized for tomorrow in two troubled East Ukrainian regions by pro-Russian separatists is illegitimate. The separatists said they're planning to hold the referendums in Donetsk and Luhansk in spite of Russian President Vladimir Putin's call to delay the vote. Recent polling shows 70% of residents in eastern Ukraine want to remain part of the country. Nearly 4 weeks after hundreds of teenage girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in northeastern Nigeria, there are a few verified details about who the girls are or where they might be. Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja on the debate surrounding the girls' identities.
Nigerians say the missing girls are the daughters of their country. Authorities have said more than 276 are still missing, but have not provided a list of names or other identifying details. Ade Ogundeyan heads ProForce, a Nigerian security company. One explanation for the confusion is stigma, he says, because families assume the missing girls are being raped, and they do not want their daughters to be viewed as dirty. Another possibility is that in northeast Nigeria, deeply impoverished, poorly developed, and devastated by the five-year-long Boko Haram insurgency, detailed school attendance records are not a priority. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The final vote count will be announced today in South Africa's national elections held this past Wednesday. Early projections show the African ruling Congress Party set to remain in power with a comfortable victory. They won 62% of the vote. The opposition Democratic Alliance was a distant second with 22%, followed by a new party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, at 6%. State broadcaster SABC projects the ANC will control 255 of 400 seats in the National Assembly, with President Jacob Zuma in line for a second five-year term when Parliament reconvenes. Thousands of supporters of ousted Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat streamed into Western Bangkok today to counter a push by anti-government demonstrators to install an unelected government. The massive rally takes place a day after the anti-government protesters stormed the capital city in an effort to take over television stations and government buildings in what they say is their final push to oust the democratically elected government. Thai riot police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators who were trying to force their way into a government security agency. In Yemen, witnesses say a gunfight broke out Friday between militants and security guards outside the presidential palace. News reports quote unidentified sources saying at least four of the security forces were killed after being attacked by the militants and exchanging fire for more than 20 minutes. Yemen's army has been carrying out an offensive against al-Qaeda militants in the country's volatile south. Al-Qaeda figures reportedly also attacked Yemen's defense minister Friday in an apparent assassination attempt. Security and military officials say the militants ambushed the motorcade as the defense minister was traveling to Shabwa province. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. There is more news and information available on our website 24 hours a day at voanews.com.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
I want to assure you that I and my party, the party I'm leading and the army that I'm leading, will implement this agreement without any fail.
A ceasefire deal signed in South Sudan as the humanitarian crisis in the country reaches a critical point.
Look, in any hostage situation, time is at a premium. And there's no question that we're racing against the clock here.
In Nigeria, the search continues for the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram.
28 is the number of wealth. You're a lucky pig and you're a 28. I mean, you can't ask for anything better. Wow, one day you're gonna be in the news for making big bucks somewhere.
And a South African tarot card reader demonstrates uncanny abilities to predict the future. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
South Africa's long-time ruling party, Handle, won this year's elections, its fifth straight victory in 20 years. The nation's Electoral Commission formally announced the results late Saturday, showing that the African National Congress won 3 votes to every one won by its nearest challenger. VOA's Anita Paul asked a prominent political analyst to break down what the numbers mean. She reports from Johannesburg.
It is official. South Africa's African National Congress has won this year's election, guaranteeing it another 5 years at the helm of Africa's most advanced nation. But there are two sides to this story. ANC officials are painting this as an outright victory, a mandate from the people of this nation to continue their work after 2 decades in power. After all, the numbers show that the ANC trounced the competition, with its nearest competitor, the Opposition Democratic Alliance, trailing by more than 7 million votes. In all, nearly 19 million votes were cast in this week's national and provincial polls. With all votes counted, the ANC won just over 62% of the poll, compared to the DA's 22%. And in an impressive achievement for a party that was launched just last year, the far-left Radical Economic Freedom Fighters nabbed third place. The success of the party, which aimed at South Africa's large population of unemployed youth, reflects South Africa's demographic shift toward a younger population, as does the fact that the EFF shoved aside the venerable Inkatha Freedom Party, which is led by an 85-year-old man, the respected chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. But independent political analyst Ralph Matega, who cheerfully claims to be equally hated by all 29 parties on this year's ballot, says the raw numbers do not tell the whole story. He noted that although the ANC won comfortably, it has lost ground steadily since at least 2004.
There isn't much to celebrate. It should humble the ANC to go and do some work. And when it comes to the DA, other parties, the DA has got a lot to celebrate. They've grown. They've increased their margin in all areas. They have not recorded any loss of margin in any province. But of all the parties, if you look around, the DA is the only one that has been able to grow election to election, while the ANC is consistently shedding 3%.
The ANC has been dogged by criticism over its failure to provide all South Africans with basic services. To this day, some 3 million South Africans do not have electricity. More recently, the party has been tainted by a major scandal revolving around President Jacob Zuma, the party's leader. He is accused of spending about $23 million in public funds to renovate his private home in rural KwaZulu-Natal province. However, the ANC, by virtue of being the only party to rule South Africa since apartheid's end in 1994, is also the party responsible for extending development to benefit the nation's black majority, which was shut out under the former apartheid government. The party trumpeted this fact in its campaign, but Matega says voters increasingly feel that is not enough.
This type of vote that they've got, it's more like a maintenance vote where the voters are saying to the ANC, they should go fix some of the problems and the challenges that they have.
That will come in the next 5 years. But now, having been crowned the winner, South Africa's largest political party is going to do just that. Party. Anita Powell, VOA News.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir signed a ceasefire agreement with his rival opposition leader Riek Machar Friday night in Ethiopia. Meanwhile, South Sudan's military spokesman says the armed forces are ready to implement a ceasefire deal signed late Friday to end months of fighting with anti-government forces. VOA's Gabe Justler reports world leaders have welcomed the deal as the humanitarian crisis in the country has reached a critical point.
South Sudan's Colonel Philip Aguirre told VOA Saturday the ceasefire order will be passed to all military forces known as SPLA in areas of recent fighting.
The agreement will be simply communicated to all the SPLA division and forces and units, and particularly in the three states of Upper Nile, Unity State and Jonglei, and it will be implemented.
President Salva Kiir and his main rival, former Vice President Riek Machar, agreed to the ceasefire during a meeting in Addis Ababa, following mounting calls from the international community to end fighting. Thousands have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced since December, when a political struggle between the two leaders broke out into violence that has prompted inter-ethnic attacks. A previous ceasefire signed by representatives of the two sides in January failed to take hold. Aguirre says he is more optimistic about the new agreement.
This time, since it is signed by Riek Machar himself, though we know he has many irregular armies under him, he will have to communicate it to those forces on the ground. And on our side, we don't see any problem.
Teams from the East African Group of Nations known as IGAD, which has mediated talks, are expected to monitor the implementation of the ceasefire on the ground. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who visited South Sudan earlier this week, welcomed the new ceasefire agreement and called for the parties to immediately translate these commitments into action on the ground. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry hailed the deal as a possible breakthrough. A United Nations human rights report released this week outlined serious human rights abuses committed by both sides during the conflict, including rape, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary detentions, and attacks on civilians in hospitals. Humanitarian agencies have warned that millions of South Sudanese are at risk of severe food insecurity if the fighting is not halted. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Pentagon says most of its team has arrived in Nigeria to assist in the search for the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. But officials warn time may be running out. VOA's Jeff Selden has more from the Pentagon.
Six experts from the U.S. Africa Command landed in the Nigerian capital Friday morning. Pentagon spokesman Admiral John Kirby says two more are on the way, part of the larger U.S. team tasked with helping Nigeria find and rescue the missing schoolgirls.
Look, in any hostage situation, time is at a premium. And there's no question that we're racing against the clock here.
Kirby says the newly arrived U.S. personnel joined 10 already in Nigeria. The aim, to help the Nigerians with communications, planning, and analyzing intelligence.
We're not talking about U.S. military operations in Nigeria to go find these girls. That's not the focus here.
Despite concerns time may be running out to locate the missing girls, as of now, the U.S. will not be using drones to help in the search, instead putting the responsibility on the Nigerian military.
And we urge them to use all the resources at their disposal, and they have resources at their disposal. To go after these girls and rescue them.
Kirby says Washington had previously offered assistance to the Nigerian government, but that the offer was not accepted until this week. He also says while the focus of this effort is solely on rescuing the girls kidnapped by Boko Haram, the U.S. will continue working with Nigeria on counterterrorism.
The Nigerians are very aware of the threat that Boko Haram poses to them and to their national security.
Boko Haram is a militant Islamic sect that's terrorized Nigeria for 5 years, blamed for thousands of deaths in attacks on schools, government offices, and villages. Last month, some of its fighters attacked a girls' school in the town of Chibok in northern Nigeria and captured the girls, the group's leader now vowing to sell them as slaves. Britain has also sent a team to Nigeria to assist in the search, expecting to work closely with the Americans. British officials say in addition to working on a rescue, its team will also be looking at ways to help defeat Boko Haram. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
In Kenya, 77 people have so far died due to alcohol poisoning from the consumption of illegal alcohol. John Matuto is the chairman of Kenya's National Authority for Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse. From Nairobi, he told me that immediate steps are being taken to address the issue.
I'm confirming the reports of up to 77 people may have died of alcohol poisoning, drink consumed illicit alcohol.
How is your organization addressing this issue?
We have taken very broad measures and very courageous moves. We are going now to test all alcoholic drinks, all brands of alcoholic drinks immediately within our border, including the conventional drinks. We are profiling or checking out all manufacturers, importers, and retailers, who they are and what they do within our borders. We are strengthening our border control so that we don't have importation carelessly. We are changing the rules in terms of industrial alcohol and its movement. And from factory to the final consumer or retailers, it should come now and fill the containers. Those are some of the measures.
Your organization has launched a number of operations to crack down on illegal alcohol. There were plans to purchase breathalyzers, yes, and sniffer dogs as well. Is it safe to say that those operations have not been successful so far?
Not exactly, but if you look at some of those things, are very new. We first came with the idea of testing all alcohol in 2010. However, the government mechanism and the legal framework and the new constitution took too long to allow us to be able to have an entry point. Up until this year in March, when the first notices were sent, so that we can now do the assembly, we can now collect the samples. So if you check on the issue of licensing regime of all manufacturers, there was a confusion because the constitution says the county government are supposed to do the licensing. But they took too long again to prepare certain statutes that would have helped them manage these factories. So this confusion between the national government and the county government caused certain advantages against us with the illicit manufacturers. We also have, like you have seen, certain challenges in terms of poor border control and the confusion on the integration date, which product should be moved using the already agreements we have or tariffs we have with our neighboring countries on Tanzania and Uganda, who apparently don't have very solid roles in alcohol management. That's just some of the challenges that we have had to face.
Now, have there been arrests made of manufacturers and sellers of illegal alcohol?
Yes, one manufacturer is arrested, the major manufacturer.
And will that major manufacturer be prosecuted? And if so, what kind of punishment will be meted out?
For every count, if convicted, he'll be charged 5 million Kenya shillings, or he can go to jail for up to 10 years for each count if convicted, selling to an individual adulterated or alcoholic drink. That appears very clear in Alcoholic Drinks Control Act, popularly known as Mututu laws. On top of that, he will have to cause compensation to the consumers using other statutes, and our constitution is crystal clear that under Article 46, A, B, and C, that should you feed people with a product purporting it to be wholesome and then they get hurt, you go to compensate them.
John Mututu, the chairman of Kenya's National Authority for Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse. I reached him by phone in Nairobi.
Experts agree that despite recent slowdowns in the global economy, new information and communication technologies remain dependable drivers of growth. Across Africa, internet growth has jumped from almost 0 to 16% over the last quarter century and is expected to rapidly expand. Now, but there are fears that countries like Cameroon, with one of the continent's lowest number of internet users, may miss out on the boom. From Douala, Ntarike Divine Jr. reports.
In January, researchers at the Boston Consulting Group, a U.S. business strategy research firm, concluded that enlarging internet access and usage can boost economic growth. Their findings additionally note that progress along the information highway is slowed by inadequate infrastructure, sluggish judicial and economic frameworks, and restrictive government policies. Nearly 6% of Cameroon's over 20 million inhabitants have access to the internet. That's up nearly 2% points from 2010, but still far below the continental average of 16%. Even so, users grumble about the prohibitive cost of access, sluggish response time, frequent connection breakdowns and the absence of internet in rural areas.
Selon l'opérateur qui propose, la connexion peut être bonne ou complètement minable.
Depending on the service provider, connections can be reliable or simply despicable. There is still a lot of work to do.
J'ai essayé de joindre un fichier JPEG.
Attaching a picture compressed to JPEG format can take you an hour. And on bad days, you may take 30 minutes just to access your mails. Yet, recent surveys, including one by the Boston Consulting Group, warn that countries with a high number of factors blocking internet spread are likely to lag behind in economic growth. Abel Kubelda, an official with Cameroon's National Agency for Information and Communications Technologies, agrees.
D'après une étude récente de la Banque mondiale sur le TIC,
a recent World Bank study showed that a 10% increase in access to the internet will engender a GDP rise of 1.3%. And that's additionally very important in terms of opportunities offered, like online education, which enables students in remote areas to learn on their computers without having to move. Telemedicine and electronic banking.
Nous avons également ce qu'on appelle le e-banking.
Meanwhile, last year, the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications successfully fitted the country with 6,000 kilometers of fiber optic cable. It links together all 10 regional capitals from north to south and branches off to remote localities in about 100 districts. The venture is part of a national fiber optic backbone project funded by the World Bank and China that aims to install 10,000 kilometers of fiber optic cable by 2015. Pauline Tsafak is sub-director of Information and Communications Technologies Promotion in the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications. Ever since we were connected to the SAT-3 submarine fiber optic cable, we undertook the development of the national backbone, which we are taking to the doorsteps of the final consumers. It is going right into the villages. Data flow rates have considerably improved and costs are gradually dropping. But I must admit, they remain expensive. Critics argue the government may be using its intention to popularize internet access and usage to boost its own image. In reality, they say it is failing to democratize ownership of the fiber optic cable. Opponents say rather than scrap the widely denounced state monopoly on communications, the government in January instead announced the construction of what it calls the Cameroon Internet Exchange Points, CAMEICs. Tsafak says despite the widespread criticism, the move will eventually bring down costs and ensure better internet quality. Imagine that you want to send data to a colleague sitting just near you. That information goes to transit through an international internet exchange hub in Portugal or London, and you pay at the departure of the data as well as when it arrives its destination. But with the installation of the exchange points, such data will be exchanged locally without having to leave the country. But experts describe the initiative as a dangerous shortcut aimed at preserving the government's stronghold on the fiber optic. They say it may end up steering Cameroon away from a continent internet boom projected to earn Africa up to $300 billion by 2025. For VOA News, I'm Tarike Devine Jr. in Douala, Cameroon.
Johannesburg police dispersed post-election demonstrators with rubber bullets and stun grenades and arrested 59 in Alexandra Township, officials say. They were protesting the re-election of South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma. Provincial officials reported that military forces have also been called in to restore calm in Johannesburg after Zuma's victory. Zuma is scheduled to speak today and claim victory in an election international observers called free and fair.
Meanwhile, a tarot card reader in South Africa is demonstrating uncanny abilities to predict the future. Usula Wania uses 78 picture cards to foresee certain events in people's lives. Her big predictions in the past include the rise of Bill Clinton in the U.S. long before he was one of the world's most famous statesmen. In the early 1990s, Wania also predicted the design and colors of the flag of a democratic South Africa. Darren Taylor reports in this first part of a series on alternative beliefs in South Africa.
Welcome to ANN7. What do you see for South Africa in 2014?
You know what? I think it's going to be a bit of a tough year. There might be a lot of violence and things can get a little bit intense. But
Wania's skill in forecasting the future through tarot cards means she sometimes appears on television in South Africa. But she sees clients at her house in northern Johannesburg. Incense oil burns slowly in a corner of a study. The air is filled with rich aromas of cinnamon, maple syrup and roses. Wania tells me I was born in a year of the pig, according to the Chinese horoscope. Using my date of birth, she calculates my personal number as 28.
28 is the number of wealth. You're a lucky pig and you're a 28. I mean, you can't ask for anything better. Wow, one day you're gonna be in the news for making big bucks somewhere.
No, you're serious?
I'm serious.
One of Wania's multicolored tarot cards shows a pink cherub stroking a lion. It's the strength card, also marked with the words good health and self-reliance. Another is the Nine of Cups, on which there's a fairy holding a wand. This card reads, wishes now materialize. Then there's the Death card, showing a skull surrounded by a wreath of red flowers. Wania asks clients to shuffle her cards, then she deals the deck. She explains that her interpretation of future events depends on the order in which the cards appear before her.
Okay, have you got sisters?
Yes.
Have you got a sister that's not married? Or maybe your wife's sister?
Yes, my wife's sister isn't married.
Isn't married, because I'm seeing a wedding coming up here.
Yes, you are spot on.
Oh, really?
You are spot on. She is getting married soon.
Okay.
Don't know the date yet. But
Wania says she feels a supernatural presence when she's reading cards, something that allows her to see events that haven't happened yet. Once, she says, the Eight of Swords, Tower and Judge cards lay alongside one another when she was reading for a client. Wania explains that this particular order of cards indicates that a person is going to jail.
So I said to her, look, I see there's some money involvement here and I see some problems and I'm seeing a lot of problems coming your way in the future. And she then asked me directly, could I go to prison? And I said, yes. She was very angry with me, that woman. But I tell you what, she landed up being a good client, but she did go to prison.
Wow.
A few years ago, relatives of a boy missing in the wilderness asked her to help find him. In a vision, Wania says she saw the boy drowning.
And they phoned me and they said, can you please help us see where he is? And I said, okay. She said, I'm going to send you a map. Maybe you can just mark on the map. And I couldn't believe that I actually marked exactly where this kid was. And they found him. And I said, you better hurry up because this child doesn't have long to go. They were able to find him, but just.
Rescuers found the boy on rocks in the middle of a rapidly rising river. In another tarot reading, Wania foresaw a major health problem for her mother.
And because of what the cards had said, she decided she's going to go to the oncology center and she's going to have herself checked out properly. I think she went in on Wednesday. On Friday, they had to take her boob off. She had full-blown cancer in her boob.
Wania says some people plan their lives according to her card readings.
I had one woman that came, and every time she came here, I said, you're going to have another baby. And eventually she came for the third time. She said, and I said to her, you're going to feel pregnant again. Do you know she went for hysterectomy the following week?
Some faiths, such as Christianity, consider any form of fortune-telling to be a sin. But Wania is adamant that tarot card readers aren't in conflict with anyone else, no matter what their belief systems.
You see, the thing is, they don't know enough because, I mean, they think of magic as being bad, and magic is not bad at all. Magic is using the elements that God has provided. So, you know, at the end of the day, we actually believe in God a lot more. We just don't go sing in church and go to church, basically. But
nevertheless, she acknowledges she's had mixed feelings in the past about her gifts.
You know what? I must be honest with you. There's been a lot of times in my life when I've tried really hard to get involved in something different, because to be labelled as a fortune teller isn't so cool, okay? Mm. But at the end of it all, I've realised this is my path, and I'm meant to...
Wania says her path is to guide people to live better lives. She insists that her tarot cards don't make decisions.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. Still to come in the program, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
But first, the Prague Marathon on Sunday will be a test of mind as well as body for the second fastest runner of the distance in history. Moses Masop took part in that epic Boston Marathon 3 years ago when he finished runner-up with a superb performance. But since then, the Kenyan has struggled with injury, and Prague marks his return to the marathon. The energetic Andy Edwards reports from Prague.
It's not the easiest of courses, and high-standard opposition will be a good test for Moses Masop. He blazed like a comet on the marathon scene in 2011, finishing just 4 seconds behind Jeffrey Mutai in a stunning debut at the distance on the rolling hills of Boston. But in the run-up to the 20th edition of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon, Masop is sounding a cautious note after lengthy problems with a knee injury which forced him to withdraw from this year's Boston in April. His moves suggest that he's not at the level of 3 years ago when he ran 2 hours, 3 minutes and 6 seconds, but is optimistic he's on the right track. Masop made an impression at an early age, and that's how he gained the nickname of the Big Engine, which has lasted to this day. It was all because of his capacity to train and race. This is far from a one-horse or man race. His fellow Kenyan Eliud Kiptanui returns as the course record holder, and the Kenyan-born Nicholas Kemboi, now running for the Gulf state of Qatar, is back to defend the men's title. Watch out also for the 2012 winner, Deressa Chimsa of Ethiopia, while a man capable of springing a surprise is the Kenyan Patrick Terer. He finished third last year after arriving late because of visa problems and had barely slept for more than 24 hours. Well rested, Terer could be a danger. The women's race has two clear contenders, Firahiwot Dado from Ethiopia and Flomina Chepchechir of Kenya. Dado is a former New York winner, making her Prague debut. Chepchechir dropped out at 25 kilometers in Boston a month ago, so she'll still have solid preparation behind her. For distance running aficionados, there's the prospect of two fine female performers in action in less competitive mode. Ingrid Christensen of Norway is a former world record holder in the marathon, and South Africa's Alana Meyer held that distinction for the half. Both will be running in the same celebrity relay team, which forms part of the marathon. Prague offers something for everyone. The elite racing the marathon, plus mass runners, and also shorter distances for walkers and families, plus a chance to see our athletics heroes of the past. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Andy Edwards in Prague.
It's now time for our Saturday music spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Mario, sala quand même est fort au Luka Mosala Mario. Pona nini oza ko baby saka usambu sa kombo no bo Mario. Ah, alembi.
Ba produinga na pa kolaka, zoto eko ma sembe sembe. Oko pete ngana zoka, lobi na swa maladia cancer. Lobi tango na kopola yo, kimi na ye. Mario, na ba ye. Mario, na lembi ye.
Ba familia Mario bakanisaka, Mario apesaka nga mosoro, nzoka nga moto na latisaka, ye na le isaka, ye na la lisaka, ye. Mario, na lembi ye. Bima, bima, nanda konanga Mario. Bonanini, nyongo ya polingo, ye.
Kupete nga nasua, epa izua ya lokuta, epa izua ya biloko, ye.
Nakuta kinga na yangoy,
ikambo mokemo salako boma
biloko yanda
koe na somba na lebiye Mario na baye yo, ene Mario na lebiyo
Mario, okutinga na biloko mombali mosusu a somba, oyoko elingi akofanga te Mario. Oyoko ilingite olia na mesa, kaka soki zue kangyo na poitrine, oliaga kopeta ngai nako boma biloko. Mario, sinasalisa yo mingi, diploma simangamu nasalisa ki yo Mario, bongo leonga kumimwa sima be, Mario likambote. Ah, mokilie, ezaka gaboye.
Mobali akutinga na bomengo asengi ya komandenga na nimi, mobali akutinga na bangenge asengi ya dirijenga na nimi, na bandiko bimana ye,
babandiko penga ye, monsieur.
Mario abimi moto, akanisi biloko na ngai ya ye. Mario na baye yo, kende Mario na lembi yo.
Mario asongi epe ya baboti, akuti mbeto na ye ya bomwana. Eko mitangwa kolala mbeto mokuse makolo milai Mario. Mario na lembi e Somba mbeto na baye Mario na lembi e
Koyoka motema pasite Nakonga moko na futaka Ilama na sombela yo Natikeli yo souvenir ya bolingo. Salina lavage, na cotine de la yona pato. Mario, na lembio. Kende na yona baye yo.
Mario. Mario. Mario Mosala Kopete Langa Bana Di Koko Banango Ya Yo Olingo Beba Mama Mobokoli
Epa izua ya biloko,
akuta kinga na yango.
Ika momo kemo sana kobo mabiloko ya nako era somba. Na baye yo, Mario na lembio. Bima bima na baye yo.
Mario na lembo ngwali kelemba, mitutu kumisaku. Na sombi Mercedes sanonon. Na ibisi Mario mkomosi topima Toki na osa promenade Toko minanjela Mario binangai Yo zonga kotenga na zali Na kumba fature Koba mwona kengamu na sombe liyo ambo Na ibisi Mario te Nga pina na poso na kumba Po eloko na sombi sika Batos pa mwona pengamu na sombi Toweli volonga na Mario Mario Akuteringa vatu na nzete
Zoto esali nano ya meme Olingio baby sanga elongi Sinyo sozu waka mosala ko baby sabango bilongi Kepa nangane stope na lembio
That was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday Commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
Yeah, good evening, Africa. Since the year 2000, the Boko Haram has been actively involved in Nigerian issues. It was not a part of the American foreign policy towards Nigeria. But events over the last decade and a half have led to an escalation in terms of Boko Haram activities in Nigeria and the growing interest of American policymakers in the Boko Haram and the Nigerian situation. There are a number of points to be made here with regard to the Boko Haram and new American interests in Nigerian politics. As we move towards the summit organized by President Obama in August, international terrorism between Nigeria and the rest of Africa is going to be very much part of the discourse. The United States was involved against terrorism before 9/11, and this was during the administration of President Bill Clinton. And I'm talking about what happened in Kenya and Tanzania. And that was a very interesting development in the history of the United States. And the act of terrorism by various groups across the continent, particularly in North Africa, add to the catalog of atrocities American policymakers must deal with now. So as we move towards the summit in August, you have to identify terrorism before 9/11 and how it affected America. This is well known. That's how the late Muammar Gaddafi was involved. And the Lockerbie affair became one issue that really angered President Reagan. And that was why President Reagan was involved with Gaddafi, terrorism, and African politics. Then President Clinton inherited that kind of problem. And during his administration, Osama bin Laden was beginning to enter the American political mirror. He escaped from Sudan and went to Afghanistan. And of course, when President Bush came around, the U.S. was now involved with terrorism out of Africa, from Sudan to Afghanistan. And of course, the rest is now history. The Boko Haram is now linked in terms of estimation from U.S. sources and from other sources, apparently, to the situation in Mali, the situation in North Africa, and, of course, to Al-Qaeda. Now, once you have this, it is beginning to create another point which is very critical for Nigeria. Nigerians are still debating about who is going to be the leader of that country. They're going to elections. Between now and August, and between August and the time Nigerians go to election, the critical problem for Nigerians is to decide, how are we going to govern ourselves? Are we so irresponsible to govern ourselves to the point that we need America to help us? I think Nigerians who are serious about their national sovereignty and their development, they have to pay close attention to their military. And the civilian-military relationship should be meaningful. Otherwise, it is meaningless. Because if Nigerians are incapable of dealing with the Boko Haram within their own context, in their own way, then it makes Nigeria very vulnerable to the same situation that happened in Iraq, and the same situation that happened in Afghanistan, and the same situation that happened in Pakistan. It might very well be that the Nigerians may be the other Pakistan. During the war for independence, many Nigerian leaders like Zeke and others from the south were very afraid of the Pakistanization of Nigeria, dividing the northerners from the southerners. If the Boko Haram is now the wedge, if American policymakers are not very careful, they might be dragged into another situation like Iraq, Afghanistan, and in Pakistan. Now, the drones are becoming very useful because the drones become something that saves American lives in Somalia, where you have the piracy on the Indian Ocean. You begin to wonder now, as we move towards August, how the Africans on their own side and the American policymakers can come together with regard to violence, victimization of minorities. These are burning issues that must be addressed by the Africans themselves on their side, or the African Union and the United States policymakers. This is my final point. The Boko Haram is just a very funny way of describing Nigerian politics. From the time of independence right up to the time of the Maitensini, Nigerians never defined themselves by religion. They were always campaigning by region or ethnicity. It was either Hausa versus Yoruba and Igbo, and the minorities were even forgotten. But the reality that is going on with Boko Haram is that it is creating now what I have been saying many, many, many years at the State Department. You have what is going on over the last 20 years, that you have a battle between the international fundamentalist cartels. You have Islamic fundamentalist cartel vis-a-vis the Christian fundamentalist cartels. And these groups have organized themselves, and of course it served their purposes, and the Boko Haram becomes a very convenient way of explaining themselves. Whether this is something concocted by some of the political elites or not, that is beside the point. American policy has to focus on how Nigerians can develop good governance, transparency, and the ability to work out a new deal. The political relationship of the elites is more important for all the Africans, because Nigerians are able to govern themselves and deal with the Boko Haram effectively. Babangida, with all the pluses and minuses about him, crushed the Maitensini group, and that is now history. When Obasanjo came, he had to deal with them. The big problem is, what are the military and police people going to do under civilian leadership to crush this movement once and for all? America can help, or Chinese, or whoever comes. They cannot do it. Nigerians must be willing to lose their lives to bring law and order in their own society. Nobody is going to do it for them. And that's the message we have today for the Voice of America and the audience listening.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Most recently,
He has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.